Hi everyone, hope you're having a great week. I'm Tony Chen and this is Fish and Bits, a business and data podcast on the world of seafood. Today, we're sharing a conversation I had with Dick Jones, the CEO of Blue Ocean Mariculture, a kombucha farm located off the coast of Kona, Hawaii, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Dick has had an illustrious seafood career, from working on the seafood docks as a kid in Boston, to leading seafood efforts at Whole Foods, to running organizations on improving traceability across the entire supply chain. He's seen it all, and for the last few years, he's been leading the team at Blue Ocean. Blue Ocean Mariculture may be one of the most unique aquaculture companies in the world. As of today, they are the only net pen farm in commercial operation in the entirety of the United States. So that puts them front and center across the entire industry. They are setting the standard. In this conversation, I had the chance to chat with Dick about his career, the unique challenge of running a farm located in such a remote location, the future of seafood in the United States, and so much more. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode, so let's dive in. Hi, Dick, and welcome to the Fish and Bits podcast. I'm really excited for you to join the conversation today and really hear a lot about the work you do, your farm, and kind of your entire viewpoints on seafood.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it. And I look forward to chatting with you here.
Yeah. And just to kick it off, I mean, I think it's very unique. I come from a different background into aquaculture. I feel like you have a slightly different pathway in coming from seafood. I was hoping you could tell a little bit more about kind of how your career got started, how you ended up in seafood, and then how you've really transitioned into Blue Ocean.
Yeah. So I've been around the seafood industry my entire life. So my grandfather was a facilities person at a company called Booth Fisheries and worked in the Northeast US and in Canada helping set up their seafood processing plants. And my father, out of college, went into the commissions brokerage business and worked on the Boston Fish Pier. And so I was always around fish since I was a little kid.
Wow. The Boston Fish Pier, that's right where I guess the seafood show is every year now. I went to school up in Boston. I didn't spend much time on the pier, I must admit, but I don't know if you go and visit that at all.
There used to be several seafood companies that are actually under the building where the current seafood show is held, the Boston Convention Center. So the convention center is at the corner of D and Summer Street, and there used to be a C Street, but C Street is now gone because of that conference center built, and they displaced all of the seafood companies, moved many around to different other parts of Boston.
Got it. And then did you grow up in Boston then, I assume?
I did.
Or in around the area?
Up on the North Shore of Boston, and really enjoyed my time at the seafood fish pier and just in the industry itself. I graduated high school in 1985 and then went right to work in our family's business. So my father still had his commissions brokerage business at the time. And so what that was is we imported and just brought in a lot of the day boat fish that was caught from Montauk, New York, all the way around to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And all that fish came to the Boston Fish Pier on a daily basis. And the fish price was set by the auction, that there was a live auction that happened on the pier. And that price would then be shared with the rest of the world. And then we sold all that day boat fish that came in and took a 7% commission. And so the company was really based on ensuring that there was volume, right? If you don't have volume, you don't have revenue. And I started full-time in 1986, and things were great. And then the catches started to get less and less over several years. And we just thought the fishermen were having a bad day. And so we said, oh, they'll get the fish tomorrow. They'll get the fish tomorrow. And little did I realize at the time, I didn't have a lot of information about fisheries management or, you know, what was happening with fish stocks. But due to the collapse of the ground fish stocks in the Northwest Atlantic Ocean, we just didn't have any fish to sell. And so our family business ended up going bankrupt in 1995. Just I didn't know what I was going to do at that point. So it's been a pretty interesting ride.
I can only imagine. You said your great grandfather started the business, so I'm guessing somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 years or so, this family business was in operation.
My great grandfather on my father's side had a seafood market in Connecticut, but okay. I didn't mention that. My grandfather worked in, I think it was in the 40s through the 70s at Booth Fisheries. And then my father started when he graduated college in a commissions brokerage in Boston.
My goodness. Yeah. And what happened from there, from your career standpoint? I understand you ended up at Whole Foods and HEB and kind of went that route, but I think I'm curious to learn more because it was such a interesting time as far as those businesses, and curious as to how your career took off from there.
It was 95. I was out of a job. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I didn't go to college. I went to work right in the family business from high school. It was something that kind of the entire family knew that I was destined to do, whether I knew it or not. And so I just kind of found myself a bit lost. And I got a call from one of my customers. It was a small seafood distributor in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And he said, look, I'm going to be acquired by a supermarket, and we will be the only distributor owned by a supermarket in the U.S. for seafood. And so I need to build up some bench strength on my team, and I don't know what you're going to do. You're probably going to drive the truck for a little bit until we get it figured out, but do you want to come work for me? And I said, sure. I didn't have anything else to do. And 5 months after I started working at Pigeon Cove Seafoods, they got acquired by Bread and Circus, which was then acquired by Whole Foods Market. So that started my career in retail. Started out just driving the truck and delivering to the stores, and then helping them do some merchandising and helping teach about the fish. And then just kind of worked my way up from there. Back in the early days of Whole Foods, every single job in the company was posted, and you had an internal chance, and you went up against a big interview panel. And so I applied for a seafood coordinator job in California and got the job. And so I started from going just seafood related from the dock to all the way to running the retail stores for seafood from Monterey, California, up to Canada. And then went to national.
Gotcha. Is there anything kind of, I guess, unique about the Whole Foods experience? I mean, there's so many stories about its kind of early days as far as kind of the business. You know, it's been seen as kind of I don't know if you want to call the holy grail of grocery stores, but everybody obviously looks up to it. Everybody nowadays want to get their products into that particular business. And I think it's interesting kind of your career trajectory, even in this kind of first step, right? You started on the docks, kind of just seeing seafood come in and then passing it on to the next phase. And then now you're in the grocery stores, basically, essentially, my understanding is purchasing on behalf of Whole Foods, kind of sourcing it from all different places in the world. So as far as kind of my curiosities, there's kind of two sides to it. One of what was there anything unique about Whole Foods that kind of stood out? And then kind of just your perspective as far as being on the other side, kind of more of a buyer now than instead of a seller, as far as how I have it, you know, structured in my head.
You know, in the early days of Whole Foods, it really taught me a lot. The first was around culture. So we had a set of core values that were in every single store. They were part of our team member handbook. You had to learn them and you had to live them. And that really taught me the power of a company culture. It was a culture of empowerment with accountability. And so I just remember one of the first times I was in a store and I was walking with one of the vice presidents, and we were relatively still new, and someone asked what a cereal tasted like. And he went over to the shelf and opened the box and said, "Here, try it and let me know what you think." And then the customer ended up buying a different box, you know, in a closed box of cereal. And that was the kind of culture that I've tried to bring through all the different companies that I've led. It was also back then a very much a work hard, play hard culture. And we worked a lot of really long days. We helped launch a lot of the vendors and the products that are out there today, not just in seafood, but in other parts of the sector. And I mean, you can look now at Annie's or Coleman Meats or others that started their business at Whole Foods and have migrated over to mainstream retail. So I think it was definitely a really great time and a great learning for me, for my future.
Yeah. And then just kind of expanding on that, I mean, I'm curious as to the seafood department at Whole Foods specifically. And I'm aware kind of your career transitioned into the traceability side and kind of sourcing and whatnot. I was curious if there's any points that stuck out as far as kind of Whole Foods' perspective on seafood. I mean, obviously, again, today it's looked at as far as, you know, very high standards. It's outside of maybe the typical grocery chain as far as certifications and how products get approved. I don't know if how much of that was applicable back in the early 2000s and 90s. It's obviously been 20 years since then. It's a very different company, but curious if you had any kind of takeaways from then as well.
Yeah, one of the things that we did when I was there was separate the seafood department from the meat department. In most conventional grocery stores, seafood is a sub-department of meat. And we found that with dedicated leadership, both the meat department and the seafood department ran better, had better in-stock items, had less shrink. So, you know, we've really focused on building a seafood-centric team and not one that punished the low person in the meat department who had to come over and work the seafood case. And I think, you know, that certainly increased our percent of store sales as a department. I think there is now a trend to kind of go back and do more tray pack and have that department of perishables for proteins under one single team. And I don't think it personally, I don't think it's helped build consumption of seafood in the U.S. So I'd love to see more dedication to seafood, and the seafood sector in retail.
With the supplies, was there any challenge with that? I mean, obviously with the meat sector, you have farmed animals, kind of, I would expect a much more consistent supply. I don't know if you ran into any of the challenges you saw up in Boston where catches weren't coming in and if that presented any difficulties for the grocery chains around that time.
I mean, Whole Foods, everyone wanted to be a supplier, so it wasn't right. Really difficult to get product. as we continued to experiment with newer underutilized species, with different aquaculture seafood that didn't have a high brand awareness, we had to do a lot of marketing, a lot of education, starting with our internal team members and then moving to the customers. And you know, I think the reports from back in the day were, you know, a person spent 18 seconds in front of the seafood case before making their decision on what they were going to buy. So there wasn't a lot of time to explain to them what a barramundi was, or, you know, I mean, it just, you had to really hope that the display that you made was captivating enough and made them hungry enough to want to buy seafood instead of pork, chicken, or beef.
Fascinating. Yeah. And then where did your career go from there? I understand kind of a couple stops along the traceability side. I really want to get towards the blue ocean piece and kind of the aquaculture side. But so far, you've talked a lot about kind of wild caught and a little bit of aquaculture. I don't know when aquaculture kind of really fit into your mind space as far as kind of its importance, you know, its role in the future, that sort of thing.
Yeah, when I was at Whole Foods, I joined the board of directors of the Aquaculture Certification Council. That organization doesn't exist anymore, but back in the early days of the Global Aquaculture Alliance, they had an internal auditing department, and we audited to the BAP standard. I was there on the board for 7 years. And GAA decided that it would be better to have ISO certified auditors and have them be third party and integrate all of the rest of the functions of GAA under one roof. So, we shut down. I think it was around 2008 that the ACC shut down. But through my career, both at Whole Foods and HEB, I went to 35 countries and probably saw more than 200 farms for all different species, a lot of shrimp and tilapia and salmon, but certainly all the emerging species as well. So I got to learn what was coming, what the trends were, and where the industry was headed.
Got it. And how did that lead you towards Blue Ocean? How did you end up? I mean, so far, again, kind of if I track your career trajectory, it started, you know, processing seafood, buying it from the docks, and then you were on the sell side. Now you're on the farm side, actually producing it. It seems to be quite a bit of a switch. I don't know if that's what you always had in mind of eventually owning a farm, but
I don't own the farm, but I wish I did. But, my career actually took quite a different turn in 2008. So a longtime seafood industry legend and friend named Howard Johnson was working for an NGO called Sustainable Fisheries Partnership. And he came to me when I was at HEB and said, we're looking to help the Gulf shrimp industry be more sustainable, and we want them to put better bycatch reduction devices and turtle excluding devices on their boats. Not only will we help them finance that, but we'll also give them these fuel monitoring devices because the BRDs and TEDs, they call them, that they were using are more hydrodynamic, and so they don't have to use as much RPMs to get the same speed for towing, and they can reduce their fuel costs at the same time, and it will offset some of the challenges that they're going to have when they basically use different bycatch reduction devices. They might let a little more shrimp out. They'll certainly let more species out. But what we need is for you to come to the Gulf and tell the fishers why they should do this and why it's important to HEB. And I said, that's never going to work. Like, what? How? They're not going to listen to me. And we went and we had multiple meetings along the Gulf Coast, and it worked. And I loved it. And with, you know, that background in the need for sustainable fisheries, and what non-sustainable fisheries did to my family's business, I wanted to make a change. And so I went to work for Sustainable Fisheries Partnership, and I helped buyers develop procurement policies that had a lot of sustainability initiatives that were associated with them. And our goal was to do the same thing that Howard did with me, is to just use the buyer's leverage to push down the supply chain and say, we just need to have more sustainable fisheries, both from a reputational perspective, from the health of oceans and the planet perspective, and in order to feed a growing population. And so I did that for 12 years at three different NGOs before coming to Blue Ocean Mariculture.
Got it. Yeah. And curious on kind of, I mean, do you see kind of that push down as one of the major drivers towards sustainability in the oceans? It's obviously one of the strong levers. I think it's one of, from our side, we've seen a lot of certifications. I think from the outside world, looking in at seafood, everybody talks about how there's a million different certifications, how some of them work, how some of them don't, all of these different types of pieces. I don't know if from those 12 years you had a clear insight as to how you see certifications playing into the world of seafood, whether it's a requirement, whether it's something that can be improved, whether it's not necessary at all. I don't know if there's
I don't think the proliferation of certifications is necessarily a good thing. The first thing I did when I got to Blue Ocean Mariculture is become ASC, Aquaculture Stewardship Council certified. We didn't need to do that. It's not a huge market gain for us to be ASC certified, and it sure is a cost. But what I learned through my 12 years in the NGO sector was the ASC standard, along with BAP and MSC for wild capture, is a great tool. And if your business, your farm, can meet the principles and indicators within a standard, you're most likely doing things right. You know, especially if you use a gold star standard like that. And so we went through the certification. We were for about 2 years the only ASC certified fishery of any species in the United States. We still just passed our certification with only one minor nonconformity that we fixed the day the auditor was here. And we're really proud that we are doing things the right way, that we didn't really have to change anything in order to be ASC certified. So I think, you know, certifications in terms of the standard can absolutely help guide farms and fisheries to act in a way that is more responsible and, in most cases, sustainable.
Got it. Oh, and so how did you end up at Blue Ocean? I know for a lot of the listeners of this podcast, you know, we're mostly salmon focused, operating different parts of the world. I think Blue Ocean's got a very unique story. But before we jump into the company and the business, interested to hear how you ended up there, because now we're hearing, you know, worked from grocery stores to NGOs and certifications, and then at some point switched over to really focusing on the farm side. How did that switch happen? I'm assuming you weren't living in Hawaii at the time.
I was not.
Maybe that's incorrect.
I was 20 years in Austin, Texas at that point. In late 2019, I was nominated to be an independent board member at Blue Ocean Mariculture. And so I interviewed and got the board seat. I was still the CEO of Ocean Outcomes, which is one of the NGOs I was at. And so I joined the board in December of 2019. And then COVID hit, and the ownership decided to make a change in leadership in June of 2020. And my wife and I moved to Hawaii, and I've enjoyed every minute of it since.
Could you give us a little bit of background about the company and the farm? I mean, I think from just the outset, it's obviously an interesting species. I think it serves a really unique role in U.S. aquaculture as the only mariculture kind of open ocean net pen that's in operation today. But yeah, could you give us a little bit of background about, you know, the farm, how big it is, species, that sort of thing?
Sure. So the farm started in 2001, and it was formed by a group of individuals led by a gentleman named Neil Sims. And at the time, Neil firmly believed that he could grow fish in Hawaii in the open ocean, address some of the food security challenges that they have here in Hawaii, address job and community needs, and grow high quality fish. And so in 2001, he filed for permits for 15 different species, and they had a hatchery that looked like an aquarium. It had multiple groupers, multiple snappers, mahi-mahi, some local fish that are here in Hawaii, and a moai and an inue, and two different species of cereola. One of which was a Roboliana or a Kenpachi. And what they were looking to figure out is whether any of those fish could thrive in a hatchery environment, because they knew if they couldn't get juvenile fish grown and to produce high-quality fingerlings at the volume that they needed, they would never survive offshore. And so out of those 15 different species they were trialing, Cereola Revoliana came out on top. The team put the first fish in the water in late 2004. And so this year is the 20th anniversary of the first fish going in the water. We're located in Kona, Hawaii, and even though we are only less than half a mile off the shoreline, we are in 200 feet of water. And so our farm is on a 90-acre concession, and we have eight cages that are that look like this one behind me here, and that are built by a company called InnovaSea in Boston, Massachusetts.
Those cages would be considered semi-submersible, I guess, from the images. They obviously look a little different than kind of
they,
the Norwegian.
They look like a right side up, upside down pyramid. They're 8,000 cubic meter cages. So each one is 110 feet tall. They do fully submerge during the evening, and then we raise them up during the day, and they're a great cage. We stock each one on a rotating basis, and then harvest and get the fish to our customers.
Through the history, I mean, it sounds like Kenpachi was chosen pretty early on. Was there experimentation with any of the other species? Was Kenpachi the only one that really thrived well in the hatchery setting, or is it more of kind of a business decision there?
From the business side, Kenpachi still doesn't have a huge brand recognition in the mainland U.S., which is the main market for us. We still sell a significant amount of product into Hawaii as well. One of the biggest reasons, besides the fact that Kenpachi are very resilient in a hatchery setting, is that There was no commercial fishery for them at the time. So they are endemic to our waters. And so we go out and we catch our broodstock live and bring them in. And so that's how we get our brood. We don't have any F1s or F2s. We just go out and catch new brood anytime we want. But the local fish have internal parasites. And so there is no commercial fishery. There hasn't been for about 30 years. And so we weren't displacing people's jobs to get the fishery up and running. So from a community perspective, we didn't have much pushback. We're also, because we're less than a half mile offshore, we're in state waters. And so the fact that there's no federal permitting process in place doesn't concern us at the moment. We are governed by the state of Hawaii, and we have a great relationship both with the state and federal legislative body.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, I'm curious to hear about kind of the social license. I feel like that's something that we hear a little bit about in the mining industries. I've heard it brought up quite a bit in Norway when it comes to kind of industrial salmon aquaculture, as far as just the public support for the industry. I don't know, is that something that you pay a lot of attention to? Obviously, it's kind of early phases, early stages, but as you look towards kind of supporting Hawaii, supporting the community, is that something, I'm assuming it's obviously something you've paid attention to for many years, but I don't know if there's anything kind of top of mind when you're thinking about business growth, kind of expanding to more sites, kind of how the public views the particular industry and farm itself.
I mean, Hawaii is a unique place, right? It's the most remote archipelago in the entire world. Populated. And, you know, we have a long, long history of aquaculture. Aquaculture here dates back to the 1200s, where we had in Hawaiian, the word is loko ia, which are fish ponds. And the Hawaiians were growing upwards of 2 million pounds of fish in aquacultured fish ponds a year to sustain the local community. We also eat more than twice the per capita consumption of seafood here in Hawaii than on the U.S. mainland. So it's very much a society that loves fish. And so for us, you know, we do things like we have a retail store where you can come and buy kenpachi anytime you want. We do open meetings for the community. I do a Facebook Live twice a year where I invite the community to ask any questions that they want. And because, you know, we're only an island of 200,000 residents, almost everyone knows what our cages out there are off of the airport, because they're very visible when you're flying in. They're visible from almost every house on this side of the island. So we have a great relationship with our community. We try to do activities with them and for them, and we will continue to nurture that relationship for sure.
Yeah, and before we dive too much into the policy and kind of growth phases, a lot of that story, I think I've heard similar narratives, like traveling and seeing some of the sites of the salmon companies and the islands that they operate in and how they benefit the community, kind of how they support jobs, support, you know, schools, playgrounds, all of those things, and how important it is. It's a very interesting kind of discussion, because obviously salmon has quite commercialized when you talk about scale, but its impact on those local communities. And then we're at this point where kind of the policy side is quite segmented between people that support the industry and that don't. Curious to kind of dive in a little bit more with you on that. But before we do that, I mean, I also want to hear a lot more on just the biology of the fish. So, you know, how long does it take to raise these animals? I've read you guys are more or less vertically integrated. I feel like when you're in a remote place like Hawaii, you need to be. You have to have hatcheries there. You have to do a lot of things by yourself. Not necessarily, like, you have less of the support, I think, of the global aquaculture supplier industry. But curious to kind of hear about kind of the operation side. You know, how long do the fish stay in hatcheries? When do they move out? How long does it take to harvest? What size are the animals at harvest? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are still learning, and you are absolutely correct that there is no manual, right? So we are trying to figure it out as we go. I think one of the biggest challenges that we have had from a fish perspective is around feed, right? We started out with the same feed as salmon, essentially, and have tried to build proprietary diets over time. But it's very difficult, especially at different life stages of our fish. And when you have an offshore farm that has different conditions, doing live feed trials is always a challenge. So we've been doing our best to try to maximize the efficiency of our fish. So, I mean, it's a relatively fast growing fish, you know, without sharing too much to the world. I mean, we're in that around 14 month from egg to harvest size. We tend to harvest right as they reach sexual maturity, so right around 5.5 pounds. And we feel like we've hit a good cadence with our growth and development of our fish. We're learning more about it every day. We work with Center for Aquaculture Technologies looking at DNA and genomic editing opportunities. And so I think as we continue to learn more, we'll be able to do more in terms of growing our fish to be not just healthy and not just amazing to eat, but really efficient and being able to produce fish in a shorter period of time for the consumer.
Do you have actual broodstock? I mean, you're mentioning going out and just catching it. So are you able to have a breeding program and kind of have multiple uh-huh. generations as
yep,
well?
We've got
but you can also go and catch large ones if you so choose.
Yeah, we have a four-section hatchery, I guess you could call it. So we have a broodstock area where we keep our brood. We harvest our own eggs. Our fish are prolific spawners, and you know, we produce about 80% more eggs than we even need, and we just can't slow them down. So they just in the wild, their strategy is to produce billions of eggs and hope that a, you know, 0.000 something percent survive. And so if you're in a controlled environment, it just, you know, it just, it's a lot of eggs. We also have, we produce our own live feed, and then we have a larval rearing stage and then a nursery stage before they go offshore. So we are vertically integrated. Once the fish are harvested from offshore, they come onshore, and we have a processing facility that we process and ship, and then, you know, a sales team and an administrative team. I think that's one of the biggest challenges that you have, right? People think of an offshore farm and just think of cages out there, and onshore infrastructure is just so critical to the entire business. The hatchery in the early stages, and then the processing, distribution, and finance, and marketing, and sales. It's you know, it does take a lot of people to ensure that the fish gets to the customer in the highest quality possible.
Absolutely. Where does your team kind of come from as far as kind of the breakout? Is it all people in Hawaii? Or, I mean, I'm assuming for the task you have at hand, there's quite honestly not that many people that understand both the species, can, you know, apply a ton of value. I don't know if you're pulling from everywhere around the world as far as the team you have behind you.
We find it very difficult to hire people from outside the United States. The visa challenges that our government has set up do not make it easy at all. And so we do have a lot of people from around the U.S. that come and work for us. It's a little easier in the hatchery. There are some really good academic institutions, off-island, University of Miami, and Professor Dan Bonetti's program is spectacular, and we have several people that are from Mr. Bonetti's program, as well as, you know, URI and UNH and a lot of other great schools that are promoting strong aquaculture programs. On island, we work with the University of Hawaii and the Hawaii Sea Grant Extension Program of NOAA. And there, you know, both the academic institution at UH, especially here on this island at UH Hilo, and Hawaii Sea Grant are amazing. They help a lot with workforce development and identifying folks for internships and things like that. For the divers, it's really difficult, and we tend to get a lot of people that either are research divers or come from the oil and gas sector and want to change. But a lot of people come from off island, unfortunately. And so we're trying to do more to develop the local workforce, not just us, but other companies that are here. So it is one of the largest challenges that we have right now, is just finding great people that want to come and work for us. Hawaii is not the cheapest place to live, and so it's a little difficult, but we're working through it.
What do the divers need to do? Are you going down to the cages every day? Kind of, is it a manual thing to raise and lower the cages? I'm more familiar with salmon, obviously. That system looks a little different from the automated feedings and whatnot. I know you've mentioned that Innova Sea provides most of your equipment, but curious as to, you know, what does it take to keep these fish alive and growing, to be honest?
Yeah, I mean, we do three functions offshore. We, you know, pull any mortality, you know, just like a few people in the world die every day, so do a few fish in our cages. We don't want them in there to attract predators. And so we go in the cages and remove any mortality. And we look to make sure that everything is working in working order with the cage. We also feed every day. And that's typically a combination of manual and automated feeding. We are investing more in automation, and so over the coming years, we'll have more automation through our feeding, and we've just installed and developed the algorithm for biomass estimation, and we've got pellet detection cameras, and we even have cameras facing outwards working with NOAA to look at any monk seal and predator interactions. So a lot of technology on the farm. But the divers do go in the cages every single day. It's not at a deep depth, because when we raise the cages, which we do by hooking an airline onto a compressor on the boat, the cage, which is 110 feet tall, raises to 55 feet above the waterline, so at that midway point. And so you can then get in the cage and you're staying the deepest depth you can go is 55 feet.
Very interesting. That's fascinating. I mean, does weather become a concern? Kind of are you able to take a boat out there every day? I mean, if you're saying half mile offshore, I'm assuming it's not quite as protected as typical fjords and whatnot. But is weather a big concern for how you guys operate?
Yeah, we are not as well protected as a fjord, but we're on the leeward side of the big island of Hawaii. So we have basically a backbone of volcanoes that run north to south on our island. And so they get a lot of weather on the Hilo side, the windward side of the island. And when it hits the volcanoes, it basically goes over most days. And so we have relatively calm seas for the majority of the year. There's probably less than 5 days a year where we just can't untie a boat.
Wow. That's really not bad. I would have expected a lot worse. Yeah. As we switch topics a little bit here, I'm curious as to what the future holds. You know, I think from my perspective, Blue Ocean is such an important farm and business for U.S. aquaculture. Again, kind of my story, we started with oyster farmers in the U.S. and really got to understanding, you know, some of the challenges between federal regulations, different state regulations, kind of the overall challenges for aquaculture. I'm curious as to kind of how you see Blue Ocean growing and how that really ties in with aquaculture, both globally as well as domestically. I think there's many different angles to kind of take this topic, but curious to kind of hear it from your perspective.
I mean, first and foremost, we want to continue to grow and evolve. I am a firm believer that you need to do your primary business great before you think about doing something else. And so, you know, the investors could always go in a different way, but from my perspective, I just want to be the best kenpachi farmer in the world and demonstrate that you can grow kenpachi or any fish for that matter in an open ocean environment in an environmentally and socially responsible way while being economically viable. And so for us to continue to grow and evolve and work towards the goal of having as much throughput in any given year as our permit will allow, that will be success to me. And we've got a little bit of a ways to get there. You know, I think we continue to fight for a legislative path with things like the Aqua Act and the Seafood Act, and trying to get better regulatory pathways that allow for aquaculture companies to have long-term security when they're securing a lease, and to be able to make the significant capital investments that you need to do in order to have an aquaculture operation. And as I shared earlier, both, you know, an offshore and onshore investment. And so we will continue to demonstrate what we do, to make as much of our data available in the public domain. We put as many of our water quality and reports on our website as we possibly can. And we have lots of visitors, NGOs, academia, and government that come to our farm, and we like them to be here because we know that if we can show what we're doing is really successful and able to be replicated in some form or fashion in other parts of the world, that there will be growth in the aquaculture sector and will be much better position to feed, you know, 10 million people by 2050. And for me, being a fish guy my entire life, that's my goal.
Do you think, kind of, if you take off kind of the Blue Ocean hat a little bit, and I want to pull from your experience kind of working across the entire supply chain, Do you think the U.S. has a reasonable, I guess, opportunity to grow the industry domestically? Do you think things have changed? I don't know if I've been, you know, closely paying attention for the last 5 or 6 years or so. I've seen a lot of developments happen then, but you've obviously seen it for the last, you know, 20 years, if not more. Do you think, are we at a different point in kind of the political conversations when it comes to enabling U.S. aquaculture?
I think so. If I look back even 15 years ago, I was telling people at that time, there is no way that aquaculture will grow in the U.S. The cost of all of your inputs, right? Your water, your power, your land, your labor, it's just too much and it's never going to take off. And through that time, there's been an evolution, not just in, you know, my thinking, but also in the NGO community and the way they think about the growth of aquaculture, right? So I think that, you know, you see this big evolution of regenerative aquaculture and a lot of algae production and a lot of shellfish production. And I think the next evolution will be smaller, but well-run, well-strategically thought out and planned onshore RAS systems, along with you know, correctly sited and capitalized offshore aquaculture on the mainland U.S., probably starting with Gulf of Mexico and then moving to the other Atlantic Pacific coast. But you know, I'm hoping that that's the direction that it goes. We have such a lopsided seafood industry between imports and domestic production. And even if you look at the amount of product that is domestically produced and then exported, I mean, we could be doing a lot better. And granted, there's some amazing imported product, and I'm not saying, you know, I just think we all will be better, smarter, healthier if we eat more fish and seafood. And so whatever that is going to take to happen, I want to be part of.
Oh, that's, I think that's a great message there. I think for a lot of us outside the industry, that's some of the realizations that we saw too. You know, I think when me and my co-founder started our business, our viewpoint was if the world just ate more oysters, we'd be in a better spot. Like it's one of those species that has so many different great benefits, both for the ocean, both for human health. But getting to that point takes a long journey. And I think for us, that's where we decided, yeah, we can make a career switch. We were tech guys, data guys, and wanted to, were willing to jump into the world of seafood for that exact same mission. And really kind of, you see all the trends, seafood's going to grow, aquaculture's going to grow. There's a responsibility to do it in the best way possible. I don't think it's going to be a guaranteed path to success. There's obviously mistakes that are made along the way. And, you know, those mistakes are both being able to talk about them honestly, I think, as an industry is very important. I'm wondering kind of how you view that and how you communicate. You know, you've talked about culture and team. To me, I feel like that's something you have to place. It has to be really important to your business, because the way I see it, you know, we've seen a couple instances, a bad biological outbreak or, you know, an escape or something, you know, cross our fingers, it never happens. But when those things do happen, how you respond to them really can make or break the entire industry, particularly for a place like the U.S. where there are only so many examples that you know, policy people are looking directly at. But I'm curious as to, you know, the way I sense your business, your goal is to create the healthiest and fish, as well as showcase kind of what the opportunity is within this industry, within this species, and really use that as an example that, you know, politicians can run with and grow the industry. You can grow the business in the entire Kampachi market. But I'm curious as kind of a lasting question here of just how does how does Blue Ocean get to that next phase? You know, what do you need on your team to make all of these dreams come true?
Yeah. I mean, look, I've been in the industry 38 years and I haven't gotten that far without having a high level of integrity and honesty and transparency. And so I try to instill that within the culture of Blue Ocean Mariculture to make sure that we're accountable and we're owning what's happening here. So if we do encounter any of those challenges, we will be honest and open and share what we're going to do about it. And I think that will, if more people within our industry just kind of thought that way, I think we would be a lot better off. You know, for Blue Ocean, our number one challenge right now is workforce development. We need great people. We have, I think, 13 positions open right now. We have a team of 70. Several of those are new positions for 2024, but we do have a bit of turnover and want to fill some positions that have had people in them. So, you know, for us, continuing to look at how we support academia that is growing the future of the aquaculture industry, to look at innovation and technological advances and seeing what would make the best sense and the best use of deploying our capital here at Blue Ocean, and figuring out how to increase the overall health and viability of our fish. And so we've got the three main themes. We know where we need to go. So for me, it really is in aquaculture a bit of a shorter term game. And you have to look at all these different things that, if you can get them right, are going to grow your company long term. And so we'll keep our eye on the short term prize and keep pushing forward as the only open ocean mariculture farm in the United States.
Oh, that's great. It's awesome to hear. I mean, as a lasting personal question, sorry, I got one more. I'm curious as to how you've enjoyed living on Hawaii. It seems like now that I've pieced everything together, Northeast Boston, a lot of snow, a lot of cold weather, kind of going to Austin. How has the last few years in Hawaii been?
They've been great. So we got here during COVID and we basically had the island to ourselves without tourists. So for the first 8 months, we got to see and do everything from, you know, hiking around an active volcano to the beaches and the waterfalls and all the fun the island has to offer. I've really enjoyed integrating myself into the community. So I joined the board of the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation and the board of the Natural Energy and Ocean Technology Park that our hatchery is located in, and helped the community through volunteering for different events. So it's been a lot of fun. I hope to be here for a long, long time. And I'll most likely retire here, whether I'm part of Blue Ocean at that point or not. But Hawaii is magical, and we love being part of the community.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thank you for being on the podcast. And I mean, for all the listeners out there, I mean, Dick, what's the easiest way for them to get in touch with you and Blue Ocean if they're interested in some of those jobs or maybe even coming and just visiting you in Hawaii?
Sure, yeah. So our website is blueoceanmariculture.com. And we have links in the team section that you can click on and send an email to me. And I'm on LinkedIn and just would love to hear from folks that have a passion for aquaculture. And if you're looking for work and you think one of those positions might be a good fit for you. There's a careers tab on our website, and you can apply and put down in the notes you heard about us on the web, on the podcast, and we'll make sure to take a look at you. So thank you, Tony, for a great conversation.
Awesome. Really, really enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Dick.
Thank you.